Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Reviving the strike, how working people can regain power and transform America.
Well, that portends to be quite exciting.
In his books, Reviving the Strike and Strike Back, labor lawyer Joe Burns argues that if the American labor movement is to rise again, it will not be as a result of electing different politicians, the passage of legislation, or even improved methods of union organizing. Rather, workers will need to rediscover the power of the strike. Not the largely ineffective strike of today, where employees walk picket lines, oftentimes to be replaced by scabs.
But the type of strike capable of grinding private and public sector employers to a halt, often with the solidarity of community and labor alliances. Joe Burns is with us now to stoke the flames of labor militancy and talk about how least organized labor continues to lose ground.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, it is our pleasure, and I try very hard not to be disheartened, because I've always been primed in my background to think as an organizer, and that organizing is a constant, regardless of what stage we're in towards building a new society. Nevertheless, having said that, it does appear that we are losing ground with such enormous rapidity. Organized labor, most distinctly from the private sector unions to now the public sector unions. And Joe, your theory is that we need to revive the strike as a mechanism for success. Could you talk more about the kinds of strikes that you mean and why you are so keen in your belief that that will rekindle and restoke the flames of labor militancy and consciousness within the working class?
Yeah, I mean, the reason that the labor movement is so weak today is because, you know, the forms of unionism that we're allowed to really don't make sense, and they're weak and ineffectual. For if you look at labor history, for the first 150 years of labor history, the essence of trade unionism was the strike. I mean, that's how we forced employers to recognize our unions. In the 1930s, it's how we built the private sector labor movement. And as I talk in my second book, Strike Back, that's how we won public sector unionism in the 1960s, even though striking was illegal. Hundreds of thousands of workers engaged in strikes, and that's how we created a public employee labor movement. It's how we won our benefits. It's how we made collective bargaining work. And that's really, that was really the defining feature of trade unionism, was, organizing backed up by the threat of a strike, which could economically impact an employer. I think what I've been arguing in both my books is that if we want to revive the labor movement, we really need to return to some fundamentals of trade unionism and really discover how employers have successfully boxed us in by making ineffectual, from a legal standpoint, the very tactic which is most responsible for trade union success throughout history.
Well, it's not only that strikes were effective, but it also in the 60s for public sector workers, they were illegal. And a lot of the things that the workers in the 30s did, like the general strikes and the sit-down strikes, they were illegal also. So there are a lot of things that were going on there in terms of legal and illegal activities, but the workers did them anyway.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the interesting things about looking at labor history, because clearly, in order to regain an effective strike, we're going to have to confront labor law. In the private sector, you know, a set of rules have been put in place that make illegal effective strike activity, such as using solidarity and so forth, solidarity strikes, industry-wide strikes, in many situations. And in the public sector, most public sector workers lack the legal right to strike. And one of the great things about looking at labor history is that what we find is that really didn't matter as long as, you know, the context was right and workers were on the move. So in the 1960s, for example, as I mentioned, hundreds of thousands of public workers engaged in illegal strike activity. And interestingly, what you find is that, you know, the employers and politicians found that banning strikes didn't work, that workers actually in many situations struck more in states where striking was illegal. And what the union movement found out that what mattered more was, you know, community support, the militancy of workers, you know, the level of organization and so forth. And I think with, you know, the attacks on public employee unionism and with private employee unionism on the rocks, we're really going to have to start looking back to that history to start devising some more aggressive tactics.
Just briefly, you mentioned solidarity strikes. Are you referring to secondary strikes under Taft Hartley?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at...
Tell us what they are.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, an example of a secondary strike and why it's so powerful would be, let's say you were striking a brewery, you made beer, and the workers went on strike. Well, today you would put out a flyer and you'd try and convince millions of consumers to go on, you know, to boycott that employer or that beer brand. It's really hard to do that kind of boycott. But if you look back in labor history, people would be able to use a lot more powerful form of solidarity, which is what I call workplace-based solidarity. So what they would do is they would put up a picket sign and they would ask the Teamster truck drivers not to pick up or deliver the beer or any supplies to the plant. Then they would go to like a working-class neighborhood to the bar and they would put up picket signs and they would ask the bartenders union to go out on strike. And that would be a secondary strike. The bartenders would go out on strike not in support of their immediate demands, but in support of their sisters and brothers who were out on strike, and the bartenders would refuse to sell the scab beer. That was an extremely powerful tactic, and the reason it was so effective is the bar owner had a really easy way of separating herself or himself from the dispute, which is basically just to find another beer. So this tactic was really workers were able to use solidarity to sort of divide employers and put pressure on them. And it's really how we were able to organize a lot of industries like trucking and warehouse and related industries. And it was so powerful that employers changed the rules of the game and outlawed these secondary strikes as part of the Taft-Hartley amendments to the National Labor Relations Act in 1947. And we find that, you know, throughout labor history is when we have effective union tactics, they get outlawed, either by Congress in this case or by the courts.
You know, Joe, I'm interested in what you think about this. One of the things that is troubled me, even recently when I look at the passage of the legislation on right to work in Wisconsin. Now, on one hand, you have organized labor there who certainly has a constituency, has funding, et cetera. And then you look at the fact that virtually simultaneously with the passage of the legislation, there was the death by cop, again, of a young African-American male. And thousands of young people walked out. They walked out from the high schools, from the schools, in protest. Organized labor was not to be seen in that context. And so continuously, even 2 years ago, when there was a much more vital overall outpouring of labor in Wisconsin, there's been this division where organized labor has not taken up the issues of the community. It has not taken up the human rights issues, it would seem, for decades, for decades, even in with some notable differences during the civil rights movement by the UAW and groups like that. And I'm wondering if part of the Achilles heel in terms of your secondary strike theory or your building bridges with community alliances is that organized labor has been so alienated at best from the struggles of community and the struggles of the human rights struggles of the African American Latino communities and so on.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the, you know, key points going forward. And, you know, it's one of the interesting things to look back in the struggles of the 1960s, the public workers, because, you know, the public employee labor movement developed, a very powerful strike, especially with sanitation workers. You know, you often hear about Memphis and, you know, because Martin Luther King was assassinated during the strike of the Memphis sanitation workers in 1968. But that was, you know, one part of a larger strike wave that kind of swept the South, where, African-American sanitation workers were able to win strikes in cities like Jacksonville and San Antonio and Atlanta and so forth by very consciously merging in the civil rights and black power movements with the trade unionism. You know, so that's like one example. There's many other examples of the sort of true social unionism that was developed during this period, and it wasn't always the majority of the trade union movement's approach, but certainly it was examples like housing workers in San Francisco going out on strike at the same time that there's a tenant strike and both supporting each other's demands, tenants in a housing project. So those are the types of examples of, you know, the labor movement really tying in with the community and developing a powerful form of unionism. And we don't really see that today. You know, people talk a lot about social unionism, but, you know, in reality, a lot of times that's nonprofit staff meeting with the staff of the unions in this sort of fake coalition. But the reality and where it's strong is in situations like this where the masses are in motion and you've got a ton of people out on the street, and that's where you develop the true solidarity.
I wanted to go back to Wisconsin, but I wanted to go back to Wisconsin of 2011, where the Central Labor Council in Madison basically recommended a general strike, which was never taken up by the individual unions, but instead after Act 10, which was the big union-busting act against public employees, was passed, they did a recall election for the governor. Put that in some kind of perspective with regard to what, say, the Minneapolis general strike. I know you came from Minneapolis.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, you know, said during the Wisconsin, uprising or Wisconsin battles against Scott Walker that, you know, where you had hundreds of thousands of workers coming out, consistently 100,000 coming out to the Capitol, occupying the Capitol. It was an example of a true mass movement that really wasn't called or, you know, led, by trade union officialdom. It's workers were in motion. I think that's one of the key elements of labor history is that, you know, these sort of, self-generated worker activity develop, and that's how we have, upsurges where we grow as a labor movement, and that's how we're going to revive most likely. Specifically at that time, you know, people put forward the idea that, you know, we should call a general strike or, you know, that there should be a general strike. But if you look at labor history, you know, how general strikes develop, and Kim Moody from, you know, formerly of Labor Notes has written, you know, some good articles on this, how it typically develops is, you know, through an extension of solidarity. And by that I mean that, you know, you don't just call a general strike out of, you know, whole cloth, but what happens is workers go out on strike, and then they put out appeals for other workers to support them. And most U.S., you know, the general strikes in U.S. history haven't been something that's just been called, generally speaking, but there's strike activity and solidarity that builds up in this sort of class consciousness. And then an individual dispute happens, you know, with the truck drivers, and that gets expanded, you know, to all truck drivers in the city, for example. And, you know, that's how the general strikes have happened, whether it be Rochester, New York in 1946, or, you know, New Orleans in, you know, 1892. I mean, that's generally what the process is. So, you know, I think if we want to see that sort of development of, you know, that sort of, you know, class-wide conflict that you see with a general strike, part of what we need to do is focusing on, you know, the little battles as well, and building up, you know, strike activity and solidarity.
One of the most painful labor activities that I recently remember in New York was over the Stella Doro factory, where the factory said that it was going to move, there was a new ownership, etc. And the community came out and was there in solidarity with workers who had spent their lives working on highly complex processes and machinery that certainly were not going to be easily replaced. Well, in long and short, the plant finally did close, and it was just heartbreaking to see people whose entire work life had been committed to Stella Doro, who would not get new jobs and who would very likely lose their housing, the potential of their kids for education and all kinds of things. So is it even possible today to really win, even with a more highly cultivated militancy? Is it possible to really win an economic strike? You know, when I look back at the PATCOs, which so emotionally burnt the labor movement, and the Stella Doros, I again retreat into somewhat of a state of despondence.
I mean, I think if you have a form of trade unionism that makes no economic sense, then it's not going to work. And that's what we have today. I mean, if you go back to traditional trade unionism of 100 years ago or 60 or 80 years ago, they would tell you that striking one individual factory does not work, and forming unionism at one individual plant does not work, because all the owner has to do is move or run away. So that's why in the heyday of unionism, we developed these national agreements that might cover 500,000 Teamster truck drivers in by 1968, for example. Or you can go back even further, and the iron molders, you know, had it in their constitution, you know, back in the early 1900s, that if one plant goes on strike of an employer, they all go out on strike. But what's happened over the years is that sort of solidarity and that sort of, you know, economic thinking has eroded in the labor movement. And it's been aided and abetted, or even worse, by the Supreme Court, who basically approved of all of these rules in the 1960s that really hamstrings unions' ability to deal with runaway shops. So in a situation like that, those are examples, and there's many other examples. You could take the Detroit News strike of the late 1990s, where, you know, a very successful strike was taken against one part of the giant, you know, Gannett, Knight, Ritter corporations, you know, and that strike didn't work either. And the reason it didn't work is because, you know, it was sort of engineered, and the rules were set up so it couldn't win. So I think as a union movement, I don't think we can just look at, you know, strikes that are under the existing rules don't work, so therefore strikes don't work. We have to say, what would it take to win, and what sort of labor movement, and how would we need to function, you know, without regard to the legal rules, you know, would it take to make sense? And in a situation like that, it means that we have to have the ability to use solidarity to stop them from running away. We have to be able to organize on a national or international basis, and that takes a lot of, you know, sort of radical restructuring of how we are as a labor movement.
Well, there's a lot of focus right now on Walmart. There's a lot of focus right now on the fast food workers. In addition to that, where would you see a sector where you would throw resources if you were an international president, if you're head of the AFL-CIO, if you were a local president in New York City right now, or any place else? Where are you looking at in terms of throwing resources, things to do to revive the strike, to revive the labor movement?
I mean, I think a lot of labor strategists and organizers have correctly pointed out the logistics industry as being a key one. And by that, talking about the great warehouse complexes that exist in Chicago and Los Angeles, that are these intermodal, complexes that, the goods move across the country between rail and freight and so forth. And there's a lot of great organizing taking place there. I mean, it's a huge task, and they face all of these legal impediments, such as, the rules on striking, the rules on independent contractors, and so forth. But I think, it's always been a key sector of the economy, and I think going forward it'll be key because it's an area where you're able to leverage a lot of power. I think that's a key area.
Joe Burns, I'm interested in what you think about the model that has been evolving about workers' centers. Certainly some of the most exciting organizing that I have seen is in low-wage industries, primarily by immigrant workers, creating community centers that have branched off into everything from creating a cooperative business to the idea of organizing car wash workers, laundry workers, restaurant workers, and they don't seem to be encumbered by some of the regimen or perhaps ego and privilege, relative privilege, of the labor bureaucracy.
Yeah, I mean, I think the worker centers is a, sort of a interesting part of the workers' movement and the labor movement, and they have some strengths and some weaknesses. I think their strengths are the ones that you've identified. They're not as bureaucratic in many situations as trade unions. They, many of them have a more grassroots, direct action approach to organizing. They're able to, engage or try and engage in some actions that a lot of traditional unions shy away from. They organize minority unions where they'll get a, rather than just relying on government elections, get a handful of workers who are willing to fight and fight the claims. So a lot of good stuff's coming out of there. Some of the, I think problems they face or the difficulties with that model is that, in general, they tend not to be self-supporting like trade unions are. Many of them rely on foundation funding, which, as we know, studying various social movements, eventually has a problem if you become too militant, is the history of, how funders, try and control the movement. And eventually they're going to run up, and they are already running up against the same set of rules that constrain unions. Employers are trying to bring them more under labor law and classify them as labor organizations, hitting them with RICO suits, which are the racketeering suits. They just had the case in New York that's
right.
Ongoing, where, one of the worker centers that was engaged in some good organizing is now defending themselves against a racketeering suit, which is ridiculous.
Joe Burns, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but I hope that this is a standing invitation because we've just skimmed the surface, and I want to make sure people read Reviving the Strike, How Working People Can Regain Power and Transform America, and Strike Back. Joe Burns, it's been great speaking with you. Promise you'll come back?
Oh, I'd love to come back anytime. It's been great. Thanks.
Good. We're going to pick
you.
This up. To rise again. Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.